Part 2. The Sorting Algorithm of Evil. Chapter 7. Officer Friendly. That Friday, I checked out of the hotel and walked my suitcase to the office by way of an express dry cleaning outfit. At lunchtime, I followed Bob's example and nipped out for just long enough to buy a sleeping bag and a camping mattress. It turned out there was a staff shower room on the ground floor for the cyclists. From experience, I knew that I could get by without going home for a while, just as long as I stuck to the rules. 4 hours sleep, 2 square meals, and 1 shower every day. Although on Sunday, I began to realise that people were looking at me oddly. Working nearly 60 hours in 3 days will do that. Okay, so for 3 days, I had no life. Except for PowerPoint, MS Project, Excel, and a bunch of Prince 2 worksheets. But after a while, I got into a soothing routine of deep focus, meal breaks, an hour off to run chores, then back to a different task that required my attention. I was so preoccupied that I forgot to twitch when I ran into Mary in the corridor, or to shudder when the engine note of a passing truck outside my window triggered a flashback to a Green Zone suicide bomber. It's amazing how much work you can get done in 3 days if you hold a blowtorch to each end of the candle. But around 2 a.m. on Monday morning, I finally had to admit that I was right down to the wire. It's good to have the world's most polished business plan or financial projection, but if you fall asleep in the middle of delivering it, the message will get mangled. So I dialed in a 4-hour timer on my phone, locked the office door, crawled into my sleeping bag, and curled up next to my violin case. Blink. And now it's 6 in the morning. My pillow is vibrating alarmingly, and it's time to get up, shower, caffeinate my bloodstream, and prep myself for round 2 with the lioness in her home office den. Even though I'm much too old for this lifestyle. Blink again. And it's 8 in the morning. I am awake, hair brushed, face painted, booted, and suited. Laptop fully charged. Check. Presentation loaded and ready at the first slide. Check. Violin. Oh, damn. I whimper faintly. Here's the thing. I am meant to be the sober and suitable director of a small but significant department of a government agency tasked with dealing with the transhuman menace. And I am about to walk into a briefing session so close to the apex of government that mere civil servants need oxygen masks to function there. I do not want to look like some sort of eccentric. As a part-time lecturer in music theory, carrying a violin everywhere I go is perfectly normal. And I need to email Danny about my tutorial schedule next semester, as we're probably going to have to find a stand-in quick. Damn, I should probably resign from faculty, or at least take a sabbatical if this turns out to be ongoing. And in the laundry, they only look at you twice if you've got a non-standard number of heads. But out in the rest of the civil service, violins are definitely not normal uniform accessories for executives. But I can't leave Lecter alone, can I? I just can't. It's not possible. Oh, wait. I carried him into a Cobra meeting last week. The Home Sec's already seen him. She's seen him on the news, on TV, for crying out loud. She knows he's a paranormal instrument. What's nagging me? Oh. The sticker. No, that definitely won't do. I can wing the rest, tell them just enough of the truth to satisfy them about the violin, but the sticker's got to go. Damn, I like that sticker. It's been a constant reminder for the past 8 years. But it looks unprofessional. I'll have to cover it up. 5 minutes later, Lecter's case is discreetly updated with a strip of duct tape. Just another musical instrument, rather than a thing that kills demons. And I'm ready to go. I hail a cab and tell the driver to drop me on Horseferry Road, round the corner from the shiny new Home Office building on Marsham Street. Actually, it's not just a single building, but a campus of three glass and steel blocks, connected by a four-story high bridge. I head for the Peel building. Footnote: named for Sir Robert Peel, who laid down the principles of modern policing by consent and founded the Metropolitan Police. Present my credentials, receive a visitor's pass, collect lecture from the far end of the X-ray belt, and I'm given directions to a briefing room on the sixth floor. People are already arriving for the Home Secretary's regular Monday morning session, and there's a coffee urn in the vestibule outside. So far, it's turning out to be so much like a regular conference lecture theatre that I feel a momentary stab of déjà vu. But students don't generally wear formal business attire, much less dress in police commissioner's uniforms. A pleasant-mannered senior something or other in a suit intercepts me once I've filled a coffee cup, with nary a glance at my violin case. "Dr. O'Brien, good morning. Hope you found it easy to find us. You haven't attended one of these sessions before, so I should warn you that we have a tight agenda to stick to for this morning's meeting, and everything will go so much more easily if I can remind you to keep to your 16-minute slot. There is an open-ended Q&A after the last of the presentations around 11:15, when the ministers may call you back to the podium to clarify any points, so you'll need to stick around until then." He hands me an agenda, shows me where to plug my laptop in, reassures me that it will all go swimmingly, and vanishes in search of his next target. The seats are all assigned by name. It's an invitation-only meeting, which is why I'm here on my own. Although given our personal chemistry, bringing my deputy director along for moral support might have been a bit counterproductive. I make my way to my chair and stash the violin case under it. I'm four rows back, at the side of the aisle where they've parked the presenters for easy access. Very efficient. I am, it appears, speaker number 7. Dr. D. O'Brien, Security Service, subject: introducing the Transhuman Policy Coordination Unit Strategy Roadmap. Bleary-eyed and tired, I notice the empty seats to my right just as a looming uniform to my left clears its throat. "Excuse me, ma'am." "Oh, hi, sure." I shuffle sideways to let him through. I'm no expert on police insignia, but judging from the shoulder boards and the amount of braid on his tunic, I think he's got to be a superintendent or above. He sits down next to me, and I try not to stare too obviously. There's something familiar about him. "Ah, Dr. O'Brien, we meet again." He smiles and offers me a hand. I smile and shake, racking my memory. Does look familiar, but we're... "Jim Gray, I was boring you last week with bafflegab about fisheries when you were snatched from under my nose by a mermaid." "Oh, yes." My eyes widen infinitesimally. "That."
"Yes."
He nods, a twinkle of complicity in the corner of one eye. "I'm one of your organization's intimates." "Ah." I relax slightly. He's another insider like Joe. Not all senior police officers know about us, but if he was on that oil rig, he's in on Blue Hades at the very least. Footnote: the laundry operates in a grey area, but some parts of the regular government machinery have to be directly aware of us. Bits of the Ministry of Defence, some police officers, units within the Home Office, and others have to be pre-vetted so that in event of a crisis, they can be briefed immediately. Normally, anyone who doesn't have need to know is kept in the dark, unless and until their NTK status changes. We do not, for example, generally stand up and give briefings in front of common select committees or the assembled Home Office ministers, but any politician who makes it to the rank of Secretary of State for the Home Department is cleared before they get there, because they may suddenly develop need to know at very short notice. As Jessica Green, is about to learn. Which stakeholder are you representing today?
Not fisheries. That's done and dusted as of last Thursday. No, I'm supposed to be back on my regular secondment with ACPO, monitoring developments relating to the steaming pile of crap that got unloaded on you last week, for which you have my deepest sympathy.
By steaming pile of etc., am I right in assuming you mean the transhuman problem?
That's...
He sits up slightly and looks around.
Ah, looks like we're nearly ready to start.
A procession is winding its way up the middle of the aisle. Jessica Green is in the lead, murmuring forehead to forehead, with a distinguished-looking fellow who I take to be the permanent secretary to the Home Office. They are followed, in strict pecking order, by three ministers of state, two parliamentary under-secretaries of state, and four more terribly distinguished senior civil servants. They spread out and occupy the front row, and then my meter and greeter walks up to the podium and starts things rolling.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the weekly briefing. First, I note that the committee are present. Secondly, apologies. I'd like to draw your attention to item 4 on the agenda, reporting on the progress on the Antisocial Behaviour Reduction Initiative. Mr. McBride sends his apologies, but he has been unavoidably delayed by circumstances beyond his control. There's been a major RTA on the A40, and he's stuck in the tailback. Other than that, the agenda as printed at 8:30 this morning is complete. So, moving swiftly on, item 3, presentations. I'd like to introduce our first speaker.
God, I am so glad I'm not the first course on the menu. The ministerial lion's ears prick up, they lash their tails angrily. The gazelle at the focus of their amber gaze is here to report on progress in fixing shortcomings in a cluster of private sector outsourced immigration processing facilities, and, oh dear, it's definitely going to be Bambi Tartar for dinner. He stumbles a couple of times under the weight of the Home Secretary's unblinking, medusoid stare. This is a woman who models herself on Margaret Thatcher, only without the warmth and compassion. The room is silent, but for the scritching of pens on paper, writing death sentences for the poor underachiever's career. Moving swiftly on. In what seems like no time at all, it's my turn to take my place in the ring. Luckily for me, the lions have already nibbled on their prey and are feeling distinctly postprandial. I am, it seems, destined merely for after-dinner amusement. Lions are a little too intimidating for comfort, so I mentally replace them with the good old sapient cauliflowers from Arcturus as I rattle through my presentation. Good morning. My unit has been tasked with developing a strategy initiative for reducing and containing the increase in transhuman-related crime. The full proposal is in your red box this morning. To summarise, we propose to pursue 4 distinct channels: analysis and intelligence, liaison and support for the police and security services, public information campaigns to get the government's message across, and finally, active co-option and deployment of the more amenable superpowered. Let me tackle these in order. I have to scramble to get my last proposal in under the descending curtain, but I make it just in time. I return to my seat with my pulse hammering and my blouse stuck to the small of my back. The trouble with sapient cauliflowers is that it's impossible to read their expressions. They're great for distraction avoidance during a presentation, not so great if you're looking for clues as to how it's being received. I drop in my seat, just as speaker number 8 stands up. Jim leans towards me, confidingly.
Great show. Excellent proposal, he says quietly.
Well thought out.
You think so?
I'm stunned.
Yes, but it's anybody's guess whether their right honourable selves will swallow it. That last one is bound to stretch their credulity,
even if you and I know it makes sense. Oh, hell.
I subside into the puddle of funk in the middle of my chair that I was afraid I'd end up in at the Cobra session. The next three presentations whiz through at high speed and then...
Thank you, and that's all the presentations. We will now break for 10 minutes before opening to questions from the front bench, says the fellow with the agenda.
I sigh and try to stand on knees that are abruptly wobbly. Jim offers me a hand.
Are you all right? He asks.
A bit stressed, I admit. I haul out a tissue and dab at my forehead. I was up until 2 this morning working on that. 60 hours of sweat distilled down to 16 minutes of concentrated stage fright.
Coffee? He asks. If you need to powder your nose, I'll fetch one for you. How do you take it?
White, no sugar, I say gratefully, then grab Lecter and flee in search of the bathroom. When I get back to my seat, there was a queue for the ladies, would you believe, in a building commissioned in the 21st century. I find Jim waiting for me with a cup of coffee. Bless him, a man after my own heart. Not to mention that he's a restful sight for sore eyes. He's well built, without being muscle bound. Moves lightly despite his height. I smile gratefully, stow Lecter under my seat, and accept the offered beverage.
Thanks. Happy to be of service. I remember what it was like when I first got on the list for these sessions. 2 hours of boredom interrupted by 15 minutes of terror.
That's about... I begin to reply when there's a ripple of silence, and our moderator stands up to open the round of sudden death questions.
Dr. O'Brien, please.
I recognize the Home Secretary's icily polite diction.
We have some questions for you.
I leave my coffee untouched and march stiff-legged, straight back to the podium. I'm too surprised for fear. I thought they were going to go after the illegal immigrant processing guy first. I find myself facing an audience which consists of about 1/10 of the cabinet, fronting a phalanx of about 50 Home Office executives, any one of whom is senior, on paper anyway, to the senior auditor. They run an organisation with sub-agencies whose combined budget is bigger than Google or Microsoft, if you want to put it in multinational terms, as Mary did, directing a couple of 100,000 staff and contractors. And they're looking at me as if I have a non-standard number of heads or a violin case strapped to my back.
Dr. O'Brien,
the Home Secretary begins, surprisingly tentatively.
I'd like to thank you for giving the most creative proposal we've heard in this room in, 2 or 3 years. Very imaginative, forward-looking, daring, one might even say.
Her tone is light, just this side of mocking.
How did you come to the conclusion that the Home Office needs a superhero team?
Oh, you bitch. I keep my face carefully composed. I did not come to that conclusion on my own, or rapidly. As the Secretary of State is aware, my organisation has been tracking this phenomenon with increasing concern for a number of years, although it is only in the past 3 months that it has become apparent that the frequency of outbreaks is increasing exponentially. I'd like to stress that this proposal emerged by consensus after extensive monitoring and analysis. We believe that 95% of the problems we've been having can be addressed by providing a role model for good citizenship. The superpowered are just ordinary people who have, randomly and inexplicably, found themselves enhanced. Most normal people are law-abiding citizens and do not represent a problem. Our headache is the outliers, the criminally insane and the plain criminal. We also have a secondary problem with the vigilante role model provided by the popular entertainment media. Some of the more excitable law-abiding citizens think they can help us by taking the law into their own hands. We need to discourage that. So it seems reasonable to co-opt the popular cultural superhero model and use it to keep the good citizens in line while suppressing the rare outbreaks of superpowered criminality. There are a handful of police officers who have acquired miraculous powers. I am not going to mention the enigma wrapped in a mystery that is officer-friendly at a Home Office briefing. And my department proposes to use them as a cadre to work with suitably vetted individuals with superpowers, training them as police auxiliaries or special constables, and providing suitable oversight and discipline. They will not be vigilantes in capes and tights. They will be entirely under the control of the police services. And their job will be to conduct operations against individuals with superpowers who have been identified as suspects in the course of regular police intelligence operations and... I paused to swallow. Then realise it's so quiet, I could hear a pin drop. This also feeds into the question of public education. If we have a fully managed government superhero team, we can give TV and media crews access to them, subject to careful control of their public profiles. The message we will put across is that vigilantism is not the solution to crime, and we will deal even-handedly with all lawbreakers, including misguided volunteers. People with special abilities who wish to combat criminal activity should volunteer to become SPCs, so that they can operate within a clearly established legal framework. Eccentrics who think a lycra body stalking and the power of flight entitle them to beat up bank chairmen in the street need to realise that their antics are illegal and counterproductive, and that the official government superhero squad will come down on them as hard as on any bank vault robbing mole man. In this way, we propose to take our current problem and extract from it the seeds of its own solution. Applause. Applause? I blink. The Home Secretary is leading the applause. Not enthusiastically, but just slightly faster than a slow clap. She's actually smiling. Although I've seen a warmer expression on a rattlesnake at the zoo. After about 30 seconds, the applause dies down. I'd like to thank Dr. O'Brien for her excellent and creative proposal, which I believe deserves further consideration, says the Home Secretary. My Right Honourable colleagues and I will discuss it and respond within the next week, Dr. O'Brien. Thank you very much for your time. Now, moving swiftly on to a much more mundane topic, the question of how to deal with our underperforming immigrant processing centres. Seeing it's impossible to issue our contractors with capes and superpowers, perhaps Mr. Jennings would like to return to the podium? I make my retreat, carefully keeping my face impassive. I pass the Immigration Department gazelle on my way to my seat. He looks just as bad going out as I feel coming back. My neighbour from ACPO intercepts me before I have a chance to sit back down. Back of the room, now, he whispers. I shakily grab for my violin case and shuffle towards the back. He follows me as discreetly as a nearly 2 meter man of steel in a uniform held together with silver braid and metal ribbons can manage. He cracks the door open and gestures me through it, then follows me out into the atrium. That went surprisingly well, he says. You knocked him cold. He looks at me, appraising, thoughtful. I thought it was terrible, I admit. She was all but laughing at me at the end. Really? I don't think so. I stare back at him, mildly annoyed that I'm not wearing heels high enough to look him in the eye. I'm quite a bit taller than average, but he's built like Superman. I'd need 6-inch platforms to be level with him, and those aren't suitable business dress, at least not in my world. What makes you say that? You were talking to an audience of senior politicians from the law and order side of their party. You don't get to that position unless you're an instinctive authoritarian who likes to put everyone in a neat little box. The Home Office top brass
have only really become aware of the paranormal in the past few months, and they don't like to have to think about it because it upsets their stack of Tupperware. Jessica Green is at least trying to come to terms with the new reality. She may be an authoritarian, but she's also terribly bright, and ambitious enough to believe 6 impossible things before breakfast, if that's what it takes to get to the top. However, I think she still finds it threatening to her model of the natural order of things. Laughter is her way of handling cognitive dissonance. The fact that you got a chuckle out of her is very positive. A negative response would be some sort of belittling dismissal, or outright denial, or even a very public meltdown and tantrum. I'd say you came out ahead by provoking the mildest reaction. Next time the subject comes up, she'll think of you with amused tolerance rather than denial or fear.
That's a very interesting analysis, I slowly see.
Officer Gray has clearly been studying social psychology.
But what do you want?
He begins to walk slowly back towards the central street that connects the 3 buildings. After a moment, I scurry to catch up. I think there's a cafe around here somewhere. Can I buy you a flat white in return for a few minutes of your time? I've got an idea I'd like to run past you. I can tail a setup when I smell one. Who are you? Really?
Really?
His smile is crooked. I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
No, not really.
All right, I confess. I attended that briefing because when word that you'd be presenting crossed my boss's desk, she sent me along. I'm only a chief superintendent, far too low down the totem pole to make policy. But then again, you're far too low down the totem pole to be making policy, under normal circumstances. So it's a good thing that circumstances aren't normal, isn't it? I couldn't possibly comment. If I wasn't carrying a violin and a handbag, I'd cross my arms defensively. So how did the agenda of that particular meeting end up on your desk? And are you a scary stalker with a security clearance or an ally?
Well,
we walk past a shuttered shop front in the side of the street. Just past it, there's an open awning and a Costas sign. He swerves towards the entrance. I'm nominally with the Met, but for the past 3 years, I've been on semi-permanent loan to ACPO, and I've been liaising with your people. I stop. Who do you believe my people are? I demand.
Mahogany Row? SOEQ Division?
So he knows about the laundry.
You take it white. No sugar, yes?
There's that twinkle in his eye again.
Nope.
This time mine's a tall mocha, no cream, 1 extra shot.
Capital.
Find a table, and I'll be right over. I select a table with upright armchairs, and pick the one where I can keep my back to the wall, and watch the passers-by in the street. I have a very peculiar feeling about this dashing officer of the law. He's far too good to be true. A year or 2 older than me, athletic, handsome, self-assured, friendly, shows signs of having a sense of humour and several decades more insight into human psychology than Bob has ever developed while I've known him. Why am I even making that comparison? It's silly and pointless. I feel obscurely guilty as I watch him return from the counter bearing a tray with 2 large cups. Then I feel suspicious. Just why is a chief superintendent who works for the Association of Chief Police Officers soft-soaping me? What does he want? I was tipped off about you by Tim Whitehead, Joe Sullivan's governor. Not to mention the rolling coverage you stirred up on News 24. Paranormal violinist virtuoso performance swats human fly, as the tabloids put it. He pours a thin stream of brown sugar into his coffee and stirs it thoughtfully. So, I asked Jerry Lockhart, and he suggested talking to you directly. I'm all ears and on edge. What exactly do you do for ACPO?
This and that.
Most recently discuss fisheries patrols with our scaly friends, and other things that I don't think you need to know about. ACPO has fingers in a lot of pies, and paranormal issues are just one of them. We handle the stuff that would fall through the cracks if we left it to the regional police forces, but which needs horizontal networking rather than top-down policy directives from the Home Office. Inter-force cooperation, professional standards, intelligence gathering, anything that needs tackling on a national level and isn't so important that the right honourable members will pass enabling legislation and approve a budget for a new national-level special police force.
Special police force?
Civil Nuclear Constabulary, British Transport Police.
He shrugs.
A problem normally has got to be so big that it's glaringly obvious that the locals can't handle it and need at least 1,000 full-time bodies before they'll approve a new organisation. Supervillains aren't there yet, but they're a highly specialised problem and they cut across force boundaries, so we got asked to carry the can.
So what is it you want?
I ask.
You think ACPO should run the official government superhero team?
God, no.
He looks shocked.
The risk of blowback is enormous. In fact, we're backing out of direct policing support everywhere we can. The scandal over the NPOIU, the National Public Order Intelligence Unit, a few years ago forced a major rethink. We'd gotten ourselves, ACPO, into a wag-the-dog situation. A subsidiary task came far too close for comfort to taking over the entire organisation and turning it into a de facto secret police agency, getting up to all sorts of unsavoury activities. Sleeping with suspects, framing people, supplying bombs. It was unethical, illegal, and could have compromised our ability to do our core job, which is to coordinate between police forces.
Really? I ask brightly. This is fascinating.
After the past few days, it's wonderful to meet someone whose problems are even bigger than mine. But, he continues, as I take a mouthful of mocha, as you know, at least one of the newly superpowered is in fact a police officer. And there may be others. I believe I can use ACPO channels to find them and point them your way. I also know who to go to within the Met to help you set up a special operations unit as a posting for them. You're going to need to coordinate with us sooner or later. The way I see it working, you and your guys as, a department of the security service, will be handling the intelligence, policy, liaison, outreach, public relations, and technical operations side of the team you proposed forming. But if you're serious about them operating lawfully as sworn police officers, you really need to go through a force. The Met is the biggest police force in the UK, and I'm upper middle management there, which is the second reason why you want me on board. I smile at him pleasantly and put my cup down.
Okay, so he's a player, and he wants something. Probably the obvious. To grab my unit and turn it into a new leaf on their org tree. Here comes the pitch.
What's the first reason? I ask. He flashes me a quick grin.
I'm officer friendly.
I give him my best vacant stare.
Is that supposed to mean something to me?
Jo said something about officer friendly, didn't she?
And come to think of it, Ramona.
I haven't been following the news much, I admit. He chuckles. He doesn't sound offended, which is a relief.
That's all right. Officer Friendly hasn't been out there fighting crime for very long.
This is in confidence, you understand, because you do have need to know, but I'd rather my secret identity didn't get noised around needlessly.
I feel your pain, I say fervently. Been there, done that. I won't drop you in it.
But who exactly is Officer Friendly when he's not wearing Chief Superintendent Gray's uniform?
I'm still finding out.
He flashes me a grin that takes 20 years off his age. I woke up with a terrible headache about 9 months ago. Thought I was having a stroke, so I got out of bed to call an ambulance and just keeled over. Fainted dead. When I woke up, I stumbled to the bathroom, didn't realize at the time that the electricity was out, and it was pitch black. I could see just fine. It wasn't until I ripped the towel rail off the wall drying my hands that I realized I had acquired super strength as well as night vision. I tried to push the rail back, and it just bent. Like warm toffee, not chromed steel tubing. He picks up his coffee cup delicately and blows on it. The other powers took a while to show up. For instance, it took me about 2 weeks to realize I could fly, and a month or two after that to fully debug it. I'm afraid I scared the crap out of the police freefall club in the process. It confuses them if they follow you out of the plane and you meet them in the clubhouse afterwards with your parachute still in its pack. That must give you an interesting perspective, I say cautiously. So you fight crime? Actually, that's an oversimplification. He shows me that grin again. I uphold my oath to enforce the law by carrying out my assigned duties. Fighting is sloppy rhetoric. How do you fight an abstraction like crime? I just happen to have unusual abilities that enable me to support my fellow officers in unconventional situations. Being officer friendly is actually a nuisance. It gets in the way of my real job, and I wish I could delegate it to someone else. I'm a super. I direct operations at divisional level. I'm not supposed to be out on the beat nicking petty offenders. Doesn't matter whether or not they can fly. Brainwash people into falling asleep or teleport the contents of a jeweler's window display into their backpack, they're still individual criminals. I take another mouthful of mocha. I suddenly feel ravenously hungry and realize it's nearly noon and I skipped breakfast. That hadn't occurred to me, I admit. It's an unusual drawback.
Yeah. The last thing you want is for your superpowers to be concentrated at the top of the pyramid instead of the bottom. On the other hand, it has its compensations.
Officer Friendly dropping in to lend a hand during an armed siege is good for morale. It's fun to get out of the office a couple times a week. And, his forehead wrinkles ruefully, I suppose it gives me slightly more insight into supervillain psychology than most officers have, on top of the crim psych degree. So you think you'd be a good fit to lead Transhuman Policy Coordination's superhero team? He shakes his head. Not lead, exactly, no. But once you've staffed it, you're going to need a big stick to keep the egos in line. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that, he points at my violin case with his spoon, is more of a sawn-off shotgun than a sidearm baton. You need someone who can handle the police procedural aspect of the operation, but who your team know isn't just a paper pusher. You make a cogent case. I make a show of checking my watch, then drain my mug. Listen, I'm due in another meeting in half an hour, and I'm running late, but I really want to take this further. Do you have a card? He nods, and we do the business card swapping thing. Great. Got to run. See you later. And I'm out of there before he can work his way any further into my confidences. He's smooth. Wow, is he smooth. He's almost too good to be true. And I did not get this job by taking anything at face value. Even straight arrow superheroes in police uniforms. Memo to self. As soon as I get a chance to check my email, send a request for information up the line. Because if you've been lying to me, Officer Friendly, you are so screwed. Picture the scene. Later that evening, It's 9 o'clock at night in the O'Brien Howard household, currently reduced to just me, my violin, and my husband's cat. I got home a couple of hours ago, showered, changed into jeans and a sweater to remind myself I wasn't working and I'm supposed to decompress while off duty, and made myself a lonely supper for one. M&S, pre-packaged salad. Ugh. And the remains of a chicken I've been working on. I started to tackle the washing up, and I'm about to perform triage on the fridge contents. It's astonishing how quickly food goes off when you downsize your family by 50%, when my mobile trills for attention. I grab it with soapy hands and nearly drop it when I see it's Mary calling. Yes? I demand, tensing in anticipation of bad news. Boss, we just got a code blue. The landline from work rings. Hang on, I tell her, and dash into the front hall to grab the ancient Bakelite handset. O'Brien here, D.O. Is this a code blue for my team? I have the unique pleasure of hearing surprise in the duty officer's voice. Yes, Doctor. I have an all-hands call-out for the Transhuman Policy Coordination Team, incident on Euston Road. Please hold, I tell him, to the phone in my other hand. Mary, are you getting this? Euston?
Yes, I'm on my way out the door.
Okay, I'll meet you there. Notify the analysts, I'll handle the DO. She hangs up, and I focus on one thing at a time. Sit rep, please. Freudstein just hit the British Library. It takes me 22 minutes to get to Euston Road, most of them spent trying not to throw up all over the floor of a police car whose driver is in a real hurry. My mobile is ringing almost constantly throughout the trip, adding to my nausea with a constant diet of dismaying information. This time, Freudstein didn't make it in and out before we got the news. There's still a chance he's on the scene, so every second counts. Mary is on her way, and so are about half of SCO-19, the Specialist Firearms Command. Everybody is very excited and keyed up, which is exactly what we don't need right now, because it's the perfect recipe for a blue-on-blue clusterfuck. My driver screeches to a halt at one end of a pile-up of patrol cars, dog vans, and firearms units that stretches halfway from Euston to St. Pancras. Sirens and the strobing of many light bars turn the night to hell. It's raining lightly, and a pall of smoke hangs on the air. I bail out, look around for the nearest body, who looks as if they're directing traffic. The cops are sending the buses and taxis that normally clog this stretch of road linking three of London's biggest railway terminals on a magical mystery tour to keep them out of stray bullet range, and walk towards him, holding up my warrant card.
Stop right there, miss. Don't move.
The constable who gets in my face this time is much less friendly than the ones in Trafalgar Square, even before you get to the semi-automatic carbine he's carrying, a submachine gun by any other name. I freeze, but raise my voice, keeping the card where he can see it. O'Brien, Transhuman Policy Coordination Security Service. Responding to control request for specialist backup, take me to...
Stand down!
The stentorian roar seems to come from about a meter above and behind my left ear.
Stand down!
I can't help myself. I jump halfway out of my skin as I turn and look. You've seen TV news broadcasts and newspaper reports, and maybe even thinly fictionalized movies, but nothing can prepare you for your first superhero. Officer Friendly looms behind me, silhouetted against the red brick wall surrounding the library campus, by the flickering light bars of vans and fire engines, one of which I now see is wedged in the crumpled and bent steel vehicle gates opening onto the piazza, stopping them from closing. He hovers a meter above the street, and I can see a faint shimmering beneath the ridged soles of his steel boots. His suit is blue, somewhere between cobalt and dull gunmetal in shade,
a thing of interlocking slabs of metal that is more like a deep-sea diver's hard shell or a spacesuit than medieval armour. There's an elaborate equipment belt, of course, and a Tetra radio handset incongruously clipped to his left pauldron, screen glowing pale grey. His face is a steel glacis pierced by narrow dark vision slots beneath an armoured copy of the regular policeman's custodian helmet. The light beacon on top pulses lazily, flaring blue against the night.
Dr. O'Brien, this way, please.
Officer Friendly descends from the sky and steps onto the pavement with a ponderous thud, boots clomping like the armoured treads of a main battle tank. The firearms officer takes a step back and waves me past, then starts speaking into his radio headset. Is Freudstein still inside the building? I ask, hurrying beside him. Officer Friendly appears to move at a slow walk, but it's only slow if you're not trying to keep up. Jim cranks his megaphone down to a merely human volume level, for my ears only.
We don't know. SCO-19 have secured the perimeter and evacuated the admin block. Two security guards are unaccounted for.
Is it on fire? We reach the stretch of curb that fronts the library's huge air conditioning outlet gratings. Now silent.
We don't know.
A group of armed officers are crouched behind the rear of the fire engine.
Freudstein's minions hit the fire station up the street. They TDA'd two pumps at gunpoint just as a visitor in the library tripped the fire alarm. When the library gate guard saw fire engines with lights, he opened the gate, at which point pump number one drove in and ram-raided the library shopfront window. They rammed the other pump into the gate to block it.
The gate opens into a piazza with sculptures, benches, a fountain, and the usual service access entrances. Viewed from the ground level on the outside, the library is a windowless slab of red brick that sprawls across almost as much land as King's Cross or St. Pancras stations.
The first responding officer attempted to gain entry, but retreated when shots were fired. Since then, there's been no sign of anyone leaving, so we've got a potential hostage situation with the missing guards, not to mention the contents of the library.
I shudder. Losing the library would be a catastrophe. The British Library is the second largest research library in the world, with over 150 million items in its catalogue, and about 200 kilometres of shelves occupied by everything from a copy of every newspaper and book published in the UK to originals of the Magna Carta, the Codex Sinaiticus, and several collections of priceless ancient manuscripts.
You're sure it's Freudstein?
If he's here, he's probably after something important. Officer Friendly reached into an armoured pocket on one giant thigh and produces an evidence baggie. There's a familiar-looking business card in it.
Found balanced on the steering wheel of the pump wedged in the gate.
Well, that tears it. So far, Freudstein's existence isn't public knowledge. But that's not going to last. It suggests we're dealing with someone who's hungry for fame. We're level with the huddle of armed officers near the entrance. A couple of higher-ups are approaching on foot, winkled out of their offices in Scotland Yard by what promises to be the major incident of the decade. I see another familiar figure approaching. She's with me. I point at Mary, and a minute later she's with us, standing in the lee of the pump, looking like either an upwardly mobile plainclothes detective inspector or an out-of-place banker.
Officer Friendly, this is my deputy director, Mary Murphy.
Mary, this is Officer Friendly. I gather as a chief superintendent, he's the ranking officer here. Mary ducks her head, and I see that sometime after I left the office, she scrubbed off the layered war paint she uses as sunblock. She looks younger without it, and almost colourless. There's a burst of radio chatter from the armed police, followed by some shifting around. One of them gets down and begins to worm his way under the crashed fire engine, pushing an assault rifle kitted out with night vision sights before him. Two others climb into the rear cab through the open door, then disappear from view.
What's going...
Wait here,
Officer Friendly says tersely. Then he gathers himself and jumps. I'm expecting him to come back down with a jaw-rattling thud, but he soars up and over the wall and the fire engine and vanishes from view. A couple of seconds later, there is indeed a loud thump as he lands on the far side of the obstacle. Then a succession of shouted orders as half a dozen specialist firearms officers pour through the open doors of the fire engine and into the piazza beyond it.
I hate this, Mary says vehemently. Who does he think we are?
I slide the violin's case around and rest my hand on the handle. Civilians who aren't equipped for a shootout.
Right.
Mary unfastens her jacket, and that's when I realise she's wearing a discreet shoulder holster. Standard issue Glock 17 by the look of it.
What are we waiting for again?
I flick the catch on Lecter's case and lift him out, then close the case and sling it over my shoulder. Mary tenses. Ever been part of a blue-on-blue incident? I ask. And she pauses momentarily before she shakes her head. Very tactful of her. Trust me, you don't want to be. Even more tactfully, I don't ask if she's been certificated to carry that pop gun. Anyway, it's not as if she needs it. I hear more radio chatter from the two cops who've remained behind. One of them turns to us, his face pale in the gloom.
Mom, the super says they've secured the piazza and established a security cordon inside the lobby and library shop. If you'd care to...
Mary doesn't wait. She jumps for the back of the wedged fire engine and scrambles up and over it terrifyingly fast. I swear quietly and take the low road through the back of the cab and over the seat backs and then slither down through the front door. I don't want to be silhouetted against the sky, and besides, I'm carrying. The smell of wood, or paper smoke, is much stronger inside the piazza, along with an acrid note that reminds me of bonfire night fireworks. My heart sinks. Whatever we find inside, it won't be good. The bad guys' black-clad minions have had half an hour to ram raid a repository of the nation's most precious treasures and set fire to the rest by way of a diversion. Police officers run past us and disperse to prearranged points close to the fire exits that open onto the piazza as we leg it towards the second fire engine, which is embedded in the shattered brick and plate glass front of the institution's bookshop.
How did they expect to escape?
Mary asks quietly, echoing my own thoughts. I don't... There's a crackle of automatic gunfire from the direction of the elevator tower that overlooks the piazza, followed rapidly by really loud return fire from the specialist under the fire engine, about 10 meters behind us.
Cover!
I shout. And Mary blurs into motion, vanishing into the shattered front of the library lobby, pistol in hand. I don't hang around either. If I could see the shooter, I could light him up with Lecter, but we're exposed on the piazza, and it's just turned into a killing ground, as witness the AFOs all scuttling for cover like heavily armed cockroaches. We make it into the darkened lobby and go to ground behind the receptionist's podium. The fire alarms are shrilling, and there's glass everywhere on the mosaic-inlaid floor. The central atrium of the library stretches up above us, but something is badly wrong. It takes me a second to realise that the 5-storey-high display cabinet full of rare manuscripts is leaning sideways, ripped away from its upper floor supports and glass front smashed, in an act of calculated vandalism.
They're still in here,
Mary says quietly, leaning close to me. Her nostrils flare. Her pupils are very wide, black holes in a paper-pale face. I shift my grip on Lecter. For a miracle, he's obedient, waiting on my command. He shows no sign of thirsting after my executive officer. Yes, and in a moment, I'm going to locate them. Don't be alarmed. I raise the violin, flick on the pickups, and finger the strings as I lean back and point the pegboard up into the darkness of the mezzanine level. Mary holds her breath and tenses, but doesn't flee. Meanwhile, where are they? I ask, opening myself to the feeling of fingers on my bony spine, an indescribable sensation. Where are who? My instrument sounds lazily amused. Don't fuck with me, Lecter. You know who I want. He doesn't reply, but shows me. Pale dots in the twilight, blue figures determinedly moving between cover as they push further into the building at ground level. Further away, carmine drops of glowing blood pierce the night like a vampire's kiss. They're down below, in the archival stores under the public spaces of the library. Typical. Office are friendly and his folks are storming the wrong floor. I open my eyes. Follow me, I tell Mary. She nods, pointing her gun at the floor, then follows as I crawl out from the desk and scuttle towards an unmarked door with no handle. An emergency exit from the staff-only spaces of the institution. It's secured by an electronic combination lock, but Lecter makes short work of it. Lecter barely gives me any warning at all when a group of cops converge on us from a side corridor. I get an inkling. Then a man's voice shouts, "You! Stop right there!" And suddenly, we're covered by the wobbly red dots of laser sights, like hungry bedbugs, only much less friendly. Mary hisses. I stop and turn just in time to see Mary raise her warrant card, glowing a nacreous silver in the darkness, as she bares her fangs at the nearest cop. The one who's talking, not the half-dozen others who are aiming.
Stand down! Stand down!
Who the fuck are you?
He demands.
Transhuman Policy Coordination,
Mary says crisply enough.
Security Service.
Get officer friendly here, I add, raising my own warrant card. He's chasing the bad guys' decoy. Their real target is down here in the stacks. Follow me, I'll take you to them, and you can do the forced entry. About 30 seconds later, we're on course for the emergency stairwell down to the second basement level. This time, with half a dozen AFOs in tow, their eyes slightly glazed by the impact of two laundry warrant cards demanding their obedience. They're all dressed in their best stabbies and armed to the teeth with a librarian's nightmare of high-energy paper punches manufactured by Messrs. Heckler and Koch. I'd be a lot happier if I was at the head of a proper Oculus team from the territorial SAS, but needs must. They came here to steal a rare manuscript, I explain, showcasing my elite powers of deduction. And they're all over the controlled environment archive along... I stop. We're at a crossroads, facing a corridor. Most of the lights are out, except for the emergency exit illumination. But the doors to either side feature round portholes and warnings about halon discharge fire suppression systems. The basements are all climate and humidity controlled. I blink, and Lecter shows me a clump of rubies in the night, just beyond the next door. They're in here, I whisper to Mary, who nods and relays the word back to our escort. I squint at the sign. Rare manuscript scores, 7612/A. Scores? Musical scores? I turn back to the cops. You have three targets in this room, I tell them. One, about 3 meters to your left as you go through the door. two others among the shelves 5 meters over to your right and about 10 meters away, near the back of the room. I'm about to step back and hand over the forced entry to the cops, if necessary dragging Mary with me because, let's face it, neither of us are trained or equipped for close-quarter arrests. Too much risk of us accidentally killing someone. When the door flips open, and everything goes to shit. There is a bang, so loud that it's more like having my head slammed in a door than anything I can call a noise. There is also a blinding flash of light. I fall over, clutching Lecter as I go down, and a couple of pairs of size 50 hobnailed boots run past my shoulder. Through the cotton wool haze in my head, I hear shouting, a piercing scream, and the flat bang of pistol fire.
"Stop! Police! You're under arrest!"
booms a voice the size of an aircraft carrier. "Oh, great," I think dazedly. Officer Friendly saves the day. For my part, I'm trying to stay out of the way because I'm on the ground and I'll get myself damaged if I get in the way of the ruck that's just thundered past me into the document store. A hand grabs my shoulder.
"Dr. O'Brien, are you all right?"
I open my eyes and see Mary leaning over me. She looks extremely pissed off. Maybe 30 seconds have passed, but it feels like an hour. "Flash bang?" I ask haltingly. My ears are ringing, and purple-green after-images dance in front of my eyes.
"Yes."
She stands, then grabs me by one hand and hauls me onto my feet. I manage to lean against the wall as I unwrap myself from around Lecter. I'll have new bruises tomorrow, but I kept him safe.
"You're late,"
she says coldly to somebody standing out of view behind my shoulder. I use the seconds to try and pull myself together.
"You shouldn't be here."
Officer Friendly dials his voice back down to normal.
"There are shooters at large."
"Yes. Well..."
I force myself to stand on my own feet, albeit unsteadily.
"What they came for is in here."
"How do you..."
The blank metal face turns to me.
"No."
I raise Lecter.
"Come on if you think you're hard enough."
The violin taunts him silently. I don't give voice to the words.
"Jim, we're from the laundry. It's our job to know."
Because we're an intelligence agency, and how much intelligence do you need to figure out that if a mad scientist sends their minions to rob a library, they're more likely to be going after a rare manuscript than last month's issue of Homes and Gardens. The shouting and banging has moved away. Lecter shows me a cluster of dots, dimming as they disappear down another corridor that opens onto the far side of this archive room because, silly me, of course you'd design more than one exit onto a conservation store full of priceless and potentially combustible manuscripts. And if you think the police are coming in through the front, you throw a flashbang at them by way of distraction before you leg it out through the back.
"They're getting away," I add.
"I don't see how,"
Officer Friendly says tersely, then clams up, obviously sucked into another round of radio comms with his colleagues.
"Oh, follow me at the double. It's kicking off upstairs again."
He doesn't wait, but pounds away back the way we came like a baby tyrannosaur in cast iron clogs. Mary and I trail along in his stompy wake, followed by a forlorn gaggle of officers who couldn't keep up with the escaping furball as Freudstein's minions beat a fighting retreat from the archives. As we arrive in the lobby, a deafeningly loud helicopter roars overhead, so low that it almost scrapes the steeply pitched upper roof and elevator tower of the museum. It's big and fast, and as it circles to hover over the flat roof of the Centre for Conservation, tiny figures scramble through the windows overlooking the flat deck and rush towards it.
Shit.
I shouldn't swear in front of employees,
But right now, I find I don't care about setting a good example. Besides, everybody else is thinking it.
The roof won't take it,
Mary exclaims excitedly. It's almost as if she wants to see a disaster. I don't think they're planning on staying for a picnic, I tell her. Officer Friendly dashes through the lobby and lifts off like a rocket, then circles around the helicopter. But for some reason, he keeps his distance. A moment later, I hear more gunfire and flinch. They're shooting at Jim. For some reason, this makes me much angrier than the flashbang earlier or the unaimed fire when the police gained entrance. Almost as angry as the desecration of the national institution we're approaching. The smell of smoke is strong. We keep well back behind the police line, but the awning over the building blocks off our view of the drama unfolding on the rooftop as the pitch of the helicopter's engine winds up. Where are they? I ask Lecter.
They? You mean your prey?
He still sounds mildly amused.
Yes, them.
He shows me. Pale red dots now, visible through the glassy outline of the walls, as they scramble roofwards.
Mine,
he says eagerly. Not yours.
Not them, fool. What they took.
Wait.
What?
I clamp down on it. Some questions are best not asked in the presence of the pale violin. Whatever Freudstein wanted, he's got. I'll learn what's missing tomorrow, when Lecter is safely back in his box and the staff have had time to comb through the wreckage. I hold the violin at the ready, braced against my shoulder, and line up on the rooftop. Then I shiver in the grip of an adrenaline-driven cold sweat as I realise that I could take down the chopper. But then what? Decisions. At least 6 heavily armed bad guys just stole a national treasure and they're getting away.
I can take them,
Lecter tells me, chillingly assured. Yes, but then the chopper would crash. And I have this vision of 4 or 5 tons of metal and jet fuel raining down on the National Library of Records rare document collection of the deaths of everybody on board, at least 6 people, and possibly of officers on the ground, and the loss of whatever they stole besides. It just doesn't bear thinking about. I can't force the chopper down and resolve the situation safely. All Agent Candid can do is destroy everybody on board and escalate a clusterfuck into a catastrophe. Stand down. I shakily force myself to lower Lecter, then unsling the violin case and re-inter him. He buzzes his frustration in the key of 1,000,000 flies as I latch the lid. Then I watch from the shadows of the broken building frontage as the chopper hovers over the rooftop and the robbers climb aboard. I've got a bad feeling about this whole situation. It stinks. Jim might be able to track the chopper. More likely it's a job for air traffic control, and an RAF fighter will already be inbound to intercept it. But if this is Freudstein, we're talking about the criminal mastermind who robbed the Bank of England. He'll have contingency plans in hand. He'll have anticipated the prompt dispatch of a pair of typhoons, and if I gambled I'd bet serious money that by the time they scream in from the QRA line at RAF Coningsby in Lincolnshire, which is 10 minutes away, because they're unable to go supersonic on full afterburner without breaking half the windows in North London, the helicopter will be nowhere to be found. The chopper turns and thunders away, the pounding of its blades setting up a matching echo in my skull, which is still aching from the flashbang and the mental exertion of keeping Lecter from going on a killing spree. Once it's out of sight, I shuffle back into the atrium to look at the gigantic display cabinet and the other cases where documents of national significance are laid before the public. The lighting in here is dim,
even in daytime, to avoid damaging the delicate treasures stored under glass in humidity-controlled cabinets. The main display may be badly damaged, but the cabinet on the mezzanine landing is intact, and I take a shuddering breath of relief as I look at one of the two surviving copies of the Magna Carta on public view. The 800-year-old foundational document of our system of government. Someone clears their throat. I glance sideways. It's Mary.
Look,
she says, pointing, with a finger that I am gratified to see is wobbling just a little. I'm not the only one who's outside her comfort zone tonight. Then I follow her direction, and my stomach clenches. The glass is intact, and the precious manuscript is undamaged. But, positioned proudly on top of it like a brash intrusion from another era, is another of Freudstein's calling cards. He's thumbing his nose at us now. Look what I could have taken if I'd wanted it. This is going to be a very long night.